Oh, in stones. It took Lady Dustin's men the better part of half an hour to uncover the entrance, shoveling through the snow and shifting rubble. When they did, the door was frozen shut. Her sergeant had to go find an axe before he could pull it open, hinges screaming, to reveal stone steps spiralling down into darkness. "It's a long way down, my lady," Theon cautioned. Lady Dustin was undeterred. "Beron, the light." The way was narrow and steep, the steps worn in the centre by centuries of feet. They went single file, the sergeant with the lantern, then Theon and Lady Dustin, her other man behind them. He had always thought of the crypts as cold, and so they seemed in summer, but now, as they descended, the air grew warmer. Not warm, never warm, but warmer than above. Down here below the earth, it would seem the chill was constant, unchanging. "The bride weeps," Lady Dustin said, as they made their way down, step by careful step. "Our little Lady Arya." "Take care now, take care, take care." He put one hand on the wall. The shifting torchlight made the step seem to move beneath his feet.
As you say, my lady. Roos is not pleased. Tell your bastard that."
"He's not my bastard," he wanted to say, but another voice inside him said,
"He is, he is. Reek belongs to Ramsay, and Ramsay belongs to Reek. You must not forget your name." "Dressing her in grey and white serves no good if the girl is left to sub. The Freys may not care, but the Northmen, they fear the dread fort, but they love the Starks."
"Not you," said Theon.
"And not me," the Lady of Barrowton confessed. "But the rest, yes. Old Horsebane is only here because the Freys hold the Great John captive. And do you imagine the Hornwood men have forgotten the bastard's last marriage, and how his lady wife was left to starve, chewing her own fingers? What do you think passes through their heads when they hear the new bride weeping? Valiant Ned's precious little girl."
"No," he thought, "she is not of Lord Eddard's blood. Her name is Jane. She is only a Stuart's daughter." He did not doubt that Lady Dustin suspected, but even so.
"Lady Arya's subs do us more harm than all of Lord Stannis's swords and spears. If the bastard means to remain Lord of Winterfell, he had best teach his wife to laugh."
"My lady," Theon broke in, "here we are."
"The steps go further down," observed Lady Dustin. "There are lower levels, older. The lowest level is partly collapsed, I hear. I've never been down there."
He pushed the door open and led them out into a long vaulted tunnel, where mighty granite pillars marched two by two into blackness. Lady Dustin's sergeant raised the lantern. Shadows slid and shifted. A small light in a great darkness. Theon had never felt comfortable in the crypts. He could feel the stone kings staring down at him with their stone eyes, stone fingers curled around the hilts of rusted longswords. None had any love for Ironborn. A familiar sense of dread filled him.
"So many," Lady Dustin said. "Do you know their names?"
"Once, but it was a long time ago." Theon pointed. "The ones on this side were kings in the north. Turin was the last.
The king who knelt?"
"Aye, my lady. After him, they were only lords. Until the young wolf.
Where is Ned Stark's tomb?"
"At the end. This way, my lady." Their footsteps echoed through the vaults as they made their way between the rows of pillars. The stone eyes of the dead men seemed to follow them, and the eyes of their stone direwolves as well. The faces stirred faint memories. A few names came back to him, unbidden, whispered in the ghostly voice of Maester Luin. King Edric Snowbeard, who had ruled the North for 100 years, Brandon the shipwright, who had sailed beyond the sunset, Theon Stark, the Hungry Wolf, my namesake, Lord Baron Stark, who made common cause with Castle Rock to war against Dagon Greyjoy, Lord of Pike, in the days when the Seven Kingdoms were ruled in all but name by the bastard sorcerer men called Bloodraven.
"That king is missing his sword," Lady Dustin observed.
It was true. Theon did not recall which king it was, but the longsword he should have held was gone. Streaks of rust remained to show where it had been. The sight disquieted him. He had always heard that the iron in the sword kept the spirits of the dead locked within their tombs. If a sword was missing, "There are ghosts in Winterfell, and I am one of them." They walked on. Barbary Dustin's face seemed to harden with every step. "She likes this place no more than I do," Theon heard himself say. "My lady, why do you hate the Starks?" She studied him.
"For the same reason you love them."
Theon stumbled.
"Love them? I took this castle from them, my lady. I had Bran and Rickon put to death, mounted their heads on spikes. I rode south with Robb Stark, fought beside him at the Whispering Wood and River Run, returned to the Iron Islands as his envoy to treat with your own father. Barriton sent men with a young wolf as well. I gave them as few men as I dared, but I knew that I must needs give him some or risk the wrath of Winterfell. So I had my own eyes and ears in that host. They kept me well informed. I know who you are. I know what you are. Now answer my question. Why do you love the Starks?"
Theon put a gloved hand against a pillar.
"I wanted to be one of them, and never could. We have more in common than you know, my lord. But come."
Only a little farther on, three tombs were closely grouped together. That was where they halted.
"Lord Rickard,"
Lady Dustin observed, studying the central figure. The statue loomed above them, long-faced, bearded, solemn. He had the same stone eyes as the rest, but his looked sad.
"He lacks a sword as well."
It was true.
"Someone has been down here stealing swords. Brandon's is gone as well. He would hate that."
She pulled off her glove and touched his knee, pale flesh against dark stone.
"Brandon loved his sword. He loved to hone it. I want it sharp enough to shave the hair from a woman's cunt," he used to say, "and how he loved to use it. A bloody sword is a beautiful thing," he told me once.
"You knew him," Theon said. The lantern light in her eyes made them seem as if they were afire.
"Brandon was fostered at Barriton with old Lord Dustin, the father of the one I'd later wed. But he spent most of his time riding the Rills. He loved to ride. His little sister took after him in that. A pair of centaurs, those two. And my lord father was always pleased to play host to the heir to Winterfell. My father had great ambitions for House Risewell. He would have served up my maidenhead to any Stark who happened by. But there was no need. Brandon was never shy about taking what he wanted. I'm old now, a dried-up thing, too long a widow, but I still remember the look of my maiden's blood on his cock the night he claimed me. I think Brandon liked the sight as well. A bloody sword is a beautiful thing, yes. It hurt, but it was a sweet pain. The day I learned that Brandon was to marry Caitlin Tully, though, there was nothing sweet about that pain. He never wanted her, I promise you that. He told me so on our last night together. But Rickard Stark had great ambitions, too. Southron ambitions that would not be served by having his heir marry the daughter of one of his own vassals. Afterward, my father nursed some hope of wedding me to Brandon's brother, Eddard, but Caitlin Tully got that one as well. I was left with young Lord Dustin until Ned Stark took him from me. Robert's rebellion. Lord Dustin and I had not been married half a year when Robert rose and Ned Stark called his banners. I begged my husband not to go. He had kin he might have sent in his stead. An uncle famed for his prowess with an axe, a great uncle who had fought in the War of the Ninepenny Kings. But he was a man and full of pride. Nothing would serve but that he lead the Barrington levies himself. I gave him a horse the day he set out, a red stallion with a fiery mane, the pride of my lord father's herds. My lord swore that he would ride him home when the war was done. Ned Stark returned the horse to me on his way back home to Winterfell. He told me that my lord had died an honourable death, that his body had been laid to rest beneath the red mountains of Dawn. He brought his sister's bones back north, though, and there she rests. But I promise you, Lord Eddard's bones will never rest beside hers. I mean to feed them to my dogs. Theon did not understand.
Is bones?
Her lips twisted. It was an ugly smile, a smile that reminded him of Ramsay's.
Caitlin Tully dispatched Lord Eddard's bones north before the Red Wedding. But your iron uncle seized Moat Cailin and closed the way. I have been watching ever since. Should those bones ever emerge from the swamps, they will get no farther than Barrington.
She threw one last lingering look at the likeness of Eddard Stark.
We are done here.
The snowstorm was still raging when they emerged from the crypts. Lady Dustin was silent during their ascent. But when they stood beneath the ruins of the first keep again, she shivered and said,
"You would do well not to repeat anything I might have said down there. Is that understood?"
It was.
"Hold my tongue, or lose it. Roose has trained you well."
She left him there.
Tyrion. The girl never wept. Young as she was, Myrcella Baratheon was a princess born. "And a Lannister, despite her name," Tyrion reminded himself, "as much Jaime's blood as Cersei's." To be sure, her smile was a shade tremulous when her brothers took their leave of her on the deck of the Sea Swift. But the girl knew the proper words to say, and she said them with courage and dignity. When the time came to part, it was Prince Tommen who cried, and Myrcella who gave him comfort. Tyrion looked down upon the farewells from the high deck of King Robert's Hammer, a great war galley of 400 oars. Robb's Hammer, as her oarsmen called her, would form the main strength of Myrcella's escort. Lionstar, Boldwyn, and Lady Lyanna would sail with her as well. It made Tyrion more than a little uneasy to detach so great a part of their already inadequate fleet, depleted as it was by the loss of all those ships that had sailed with Lord Stannis to Dragonstone and never returned. But Cersei would hear of nothing less. Perhaps she was wise. If the girl was captured before she reached Sunspear, the Dornish alliance would fall to pieces. So far, Doran Martell had done no more than call his banners. Once Myrcella was safe in Braavos, he had pledged to move his strength to the high passes, where the threat might make some of the marcher lords rethink their loyalties and give Stannis pause about marching north. It was purely a feint, however. The Martells would not commit to actual battle unless Dorne itself was attacked. And Stannis was not so great a fool. "Though some of his bannermen may be," Tyrion reflected. "I should think on that." He cleared his throat.
You know your orders, Captain?
I do, my lord. We are to follow the coast, staying always in sight of land until we reach Crackclaw Point. From there we are to strike out across the narrow sea for Bravos. On no account are we to sail within sight of Dragonstone.
And if our foe should chance upon you nonetheless?
If a single ship, we are to run them off or destroy them. If there are more, the Bullwind will cleave to the Sea Swift to protect her while the rest of the fleet does battle.
Tyrion nodded. If the worst happened, the little Sea Swift ought to be able to outrun pursuit. A small ship with big sails, she was faster than any warship afloat, or so her captain had claimed. Once Marcella reached Bravos, she ought to be safe. He was sending Sir Aerys Oakheart as her sworn shield, and had engaged the Bravosi to bring her the rest of the way to Sunspear. Even Lord Stannis would hesitate to wake the anger of the greatest and most powerful of the free cities. Travelling from King's Landing to Dorne by way of Bravos was scarcely the most direct of routes, but it was the safest, or so he hoped. If Lord Stannis knew of this sailing, he could not choose a better time to send his fleet against us. Tyrion glanced back to where the rush emptied into Blackwater Bay, and was relieved to see no sign of sails on the wide green horizon. At last report, the Baratheon fleet still lay off Storm's End, where Sir Courtney Penrose continued to defy the besiegers in Dead Renly's name. Meanwhile, Tyrion's winch towers stood three quarters complete. Even now men were hoisting heavy blocks of stone into place, no doubt cursing him for making them work through the festivities. Let them curse. Another fortnight, Stannis, that's all I require. Another fortnight, and it will be done. Tyrion watched his niece kneel before the High Septon to receive his blessing on her voyage. Sunlight caught in the crystal crown and spilled rainbows across Marcella's upturned face. The noise from the riverside made it impossible to hear the prayers. He hoped the guards had sharper ears. The High Septon was as fat as a house, and more pompous and long of wind than even Pycelle.
"Enough, old man, make an end to it," Tyrion thought irritably. "The guards have better things to do than listen to you, and so do I."
When at last the droning and mumbling was done, Tyrion took his farewell of the captain of Robb's Hammer.
"Deliver my niece safely to Bravos, and there will be a knighthood waiting for you on your return," he promised.
As he made his way down the steep plank to the quay, Tyrion could feel unkind eyes upon him. The galley rocked gently, and the movement underfoot made his waddle worse than ever.
I'll wager they'd love to snigger.
No one dared, not openly, though he heard mutterings mingled with the creak of wood and rope and the rush of the river round the pilings.
"They do not love me," he thought. "Well, small wonder. I am well fed and ugly, and they are starving."
Bronn escorted him through the crowd to join his sister and her sons. Cersei ignored him, preferring to lavish her smiles on their cousin. He watched her charming Lancel with eyes as green as the rope of emeralds around her slim white throat, and smiled a small sly smile to himself.
"I know your secret, Cersei," he thought.
His sister had oft called upon the High Septon of late to seek the blessings of the gods in their coming struggle with Lord Stannis, or so she would have him believe. In truth, after a brief call at the great Sept of Baelor, Cersei would don a plain brown traveller's cloak and steal off to meet a certain hedge knight with the unlikely name of Sir Osmond Kettleblack and his equally unsavoury brothers, Osney and Osfrid. Lancel had told him all about them. Cersei meant to use the Kettleblacks to buy her own force of sellswords. Well, let her enjoy her plots. She was much sweeter when she thought she was outwitting him. The Kettleblacks would charm her, take her coin, and promise her anything she asked, and why not, when Bronn was matching every copper penny coin for coin. Amiable rogues, all three. The brothers were in truth more skilled at deceit than they'd ever been at bloodletting. Cersei had managed to buy herself three hollow drums. They would make all the fierce booming sounds she required, but there was nothing inside. It amused Tyrion no end. Horns blew fanfares as Lionstar and Lady Lyanna pushed out from the shore, moving downriver to clear the way for Sea Swift. A few cheers went up from the crush along the banks, as thin and ragged as the clouds scuttling overhead. Marcella smiled and waved from the deck. Behind her stood Ares Oakheart, his white cloak streaming. The captain ordered lines cast off, and oars pushed the Sea Swift out into the lusty current of the Blackwater Rush, where her sails blossomed in the wind. Common white sails, as Tyrion had insisted, not sheets of Lannister crimson. Prince Tommen subbed.
"You mew like a suckling babe," his brother hissed at him. "Princes aren't supposed to cry."
Prince Aemon, the Dragon Knight, cried the day Princess Nereus wed his brother Aegon, Sansa Stark said, and the twins, Sir Arryk and Sir Eric, died with tears on their cheeks after each had given the other a mortal wound.
"Be quiet, or I'll have some Meryn give you a mortal wound," Joffrey told his betrothed.
Tyrion glanced at his sister, but Cersei was engrossed in something Sir Balon Swan was telling her.
"Can she truly be so blind as to what he is?" he wondered.
Out on the river, Bold Wynne unshipped her oars and glided downstream in the wake of Sea Swift. Last came King Robert's Hammer, the might of the royal fleet, or at least that portion that had not fled to Dragonstone last year with Stannis. Tyrion had chosen the ships with care, avoiding any whose captains might be of doubtful loyalty, according to Varys. But as Varys himself was of doubtful loyalty, a certain amount of apprehension remained.
"I rely too much on Varys," he reflected. "I need my own informers. Not that I trust them either.
Trust would get you killed." He wondered again about Littlefinger. There had been no word from Petyr Baelish since he had ridden off for Bitterbridge. That might mean nothing or everything. Even Varys could not say. The eunuch had suggested that perhaps Littlefinger had met some misfortune on the roads. He might even be slain. Tyrion had snorted in derision.
"If Littlefinger is dead, then I am a giant."
More likely, the Tyrells were balking at the proposed marriage. Tyrion could scarcely blame them.
"If I were Mace Tyrell, I would sooner have Joffrey's head on a pike than his cock in my daughter."
The little fleet was well out into the bay when Cersei indicated that it was time to go. Bronn brought Tyrion's horse and helped him mount. That was Podrick Payne's task, but they had left Pod back at the Red Keep. The gaunt sellsword made for a much more reassuring presence than the boy would have. The narrow streets were lined by men of the city watch, holding back the crowd with the shafts of their spears. Sir Jaslyn Bywater went in front, heading a wedge of mounted lancers in black ringmail and golden cloaks. Behind him came Sir Aeron Santigar and Sir Balon Swan, bearing the king's banners, the Lion of Lannister and the crowned stag of Baratheon. King Joffrey followed on a tall grey palfrey, a golden crown set upon his golden curls. Sansa Stark rode a chestnut mare at his side, looking neither right nor left, her thick auburn hair flowing to her shoulders beneath a net of moonstones. Two of the king's guard flanked the couple, the Hound on the king's right hand, and Sir Mandon Moore to the left of the Stark girl. Next came Tommen, snuffling, with Sir Preston Greenfield in his wide armour and cloak, and then Cersei, accompanied by Sir Lancel and protected by Meryn Trant and Boris Blunt. Tyrion fell in with his sister. After them followed the High Septon in his litter, and a long tail of other courtiers, Sir Horace Redwine, Lady Tanda and her daughter, Jalabar Zo, Lord Giles Rosby, and the rest. A double column of guardsmen brought up the rear. The unshaven and unwashed stared at the riders with dull resentment from behind the line of spears. "I like this not one speck," Tyrion thought. Bronn had a score of sellswords scattered through the crowd, with orders to stop any trouble before it started. Perhaps Cersei had similarly disposed her kettleblacks. Somehow Tyrion did not think it would help much. If the fire was too hot, You could hardly keep the pudding from scorching by tossing a handful of raisins in the pot. They crossed Fishmonger Square and rode along Muddy Way before turning onto the narrow, curving hook to begin the climb up Aegon's High Hill. A few voices raised a cry of, "Joffrey! All hail! All hail!" as the young king rode by, but for every man who picked up the shout, 100 kept their silence. The Lannisters moved through a sea of ragged men and hungry women, breasting a tide of sullen eyes. Just ahead of him, Cersei was laughing at something Lancel had said, though he suspected her merriment was feigned. She could not be oblivious to the unrest around them, but his sister always believed in putting on the brave show. Halfway along the route, a wailing woman forced her way between two watchmen and ran out into the street in front of the king and his companions, holding the corpse of her dead baby above her head. It was blue and swollen, grotesque, but the real horror was the mother's eyes. Joffrey looked for a moment as if he meant to ride her down, but Sansa Stark leaned over and said something to him. The king fumbled in his purse and flung the woman a silver stag. The coin bounced off the child and rolled away under the legs of the gold cloaks and into the crowd, where a dozen men began to fight for it. The mother never once blinked. Her skinny arms were trembling from the dead weight of her son. "Leave her, Your Grace," Cersei called out to the king. "She is beyond our help, poor thing." The mother heard her. Somehow the queen's voice cut through the woman's ravaged wits. Her slack face twisted in loathing.
"Whore!" she shrieked. "Kingslayer's whore! Brother fucker!"
Her dead child dropped from her arms like a sack of flour as she pointed at Cersei.
"Brother fucker! Brother fucker! Brother fucker!"
Tyrion never saw who threw the dung. He only heard Sansa's gasp and Joffrey's bellowed curse, and when he turned his head, the king was wiping brown filth from his cheek. There was more caked in his golden hair and spattered over Sansa's legs.
"Who threw that?"
Joffrey screamed. He pushed his fingers into his hair, made a furious face, and flung away another handful of dung.
"I want the man who threw that," he shouted. 100 golden dragons to the man who gives him up!"
"He was up there!"
someone shouted from the crowd. The king wheeled his horse in a circle to survey the rooftops and open balconies above them. In the crowd, people were pointing, shoving, cursing one another and the king.
"Please, Your Grace, let him go," Sansa pleaded.
The king paid her no heed.
"Bring me the man who flung that filth!"
Joffrey commanded.
"He'll lick it off me, or I'll have his head. Dog, you bring him here."
Obedient, Sandor Clegane swung down from his saddle, but there was no way through that wall of flesh, let alone to the roof. Those closest to him began to squirm and shove to get away, while others pushed forward to see. Tyrion smelled disaster.
"Clegane, leave off. The man is long fled."
"I want him," Joffrey pointed at the roof. "He was up there. Dog, cut through them and bring—"
A tumult of sound drowned his last words, a rolling thunder of rage and fear and hatred that engulfed them from all sides.
"Bastard!" someone screamed at Joffrey. "Bastard monster!"
Other voices flung calls of "whore" and "brother fucker" at the queen, while Tyrion was pelted with shouts of "freak" and "half-man." Mixed in with the abuse, he heard a few cries of
"justice!" and "Rob, King Rob, the young wolf of Stannis," and even "Renly."
From both sides of the street, the crowd surged against the spear shafts while the gold cloak struggled to hold the line. Stones and dung and fouler things whistled overhead.
"Feed us!" a woman shouted. "Bread!" boomed a man behind her. "We want bread, bastard!"
In a heartbeat, 1,000 voices took up the chant. King Joffrey and King Rob and King Stannis were forgotten, and King Bread ruled alone.
"Bread!" they clamoured. "Bread! Bread!"
Tyrion spurred to his sister's side, yelling,
"Back to the castle, now!"
Cersei gave a curt nod, and Sir Lancel unsheathed his sword. Ahead of the column, Jaslyn Bywater was roaring commands. His riders lowered their lances and drove forward in a wedge. The king was wheeling his palfrey around in anxious circles while hands reached past the line of gold cloaks grasping for him. One managed to get hold of his leg, but only for an instant. Sir Mandan's sword slashed down, parting hand from wrist. "Ride!" Tyrion shouted at his nephew, giving the horse a sharp smack on the rump. The animal reared, trumpeting, and plunged ahead, the press shattering before him. Tyrion rode into the gap hard on the king's hooves. Bronn kept pace, sword in hand. A jagged rock flew past his head as he rode, and a rotten cabbage exploded against Sir Mandan's shield. To the left, three gold cloaks went down under the surge, and then the crowd was rushing forward, trampling the fallen men. The hound had vanished behind, though his riderless horse galloped beside them. Tyrion saw Aeron Santigar pull from the saddle, the golden-black Baratheon stag torn from his grasp. Sir Balon Swan dropped the Lannister lion to draw his longsword. He slashed right and left as the fallen banner was ripped apart, the thousand ragged pieces swirling away like crimson leaves in a storm wind. In an instant they were gone. Someone staggered in front of Joffrey's horse and shrieked as the king rode him down. Whether it had been man, woman, or child, Tyrion could not have said. Joffrey was galloping at his side, way-faced, and Sir Mandan Mor a white shadow on his left. And suddenly, the madness was behind, and they were clattering across the cobble square that fronted on the castle barbican. A line of spearmen held the gates. Sir Jaslyn was wheeling his lances around for another charge. The spears parted to let the king's party pass under the portcullis. Pale red walls loomed up about them, reassuringly high and aswarm with crossbowmen. Tyrion did not recall dismounting. Sir Mandan was helping the shaken king off his horse when Cersei, Tommen, and Lancel rode through the gates with Sir Meryn and Sir Boris close behind. Boris had blood smeared along his blade, while Meryn's white cloak had been torn from his back. Sir Balon Swan rode in helmetless, his mount lathered and bleeding at the mouth. Horace Redwine brought in Lady Tanda, half crazed with fear for her daughter Lollys, who had been knocked from the saddle and left behind. Lord Giles, more grey of face than ever, stammered out a tale of seeing the High Septon spilled from his litter, screeching prayers as the crowd swept over him. Jalabar Zoe said he thought he'd seen Sir Preston Greenfield of the King's Guard riding back toward the High Septon's overturned litter, but he was not certain. Tyrion was dimly aware of a maester asking if he was injured. He pushed his way across the yard to where his nephew stood, his dung-encrusted crown askew. "Traitors!" Geoffrey was babbling excitedly. I'll have all the heads, I'll—" The dwarf slapped his flushed face so hard the crown flew from Geoffrey's head. Then he shoved him with both hands and knocked him sprawling. "You blind, bloody fool! They were traitors!" Geoffrey squealed from the ground. "They called me names and attacked me. You set your dog on them. What did you imagine they would do? Bend their knee meekly while the hound lopped off some limbs? You spoiled, witless little boy. You've killed Clegane, and gods know how many more, and yet you come through unscathed. Damn you!" And he kicked him. It felt so good, he might have done more. But Sir Mandan Mor pulled him off as Joffrey howled, and then Bronn was there to take him in hand. Cersei knelt over her son, while Sir Balon Swan restrained Sir Lancel. Tyrion wrenched free of Bronn's grip. "How many are still out there?" he shouted to no one and everyone. "My daughter," cried Lady Tanda. "Please, someone must go back for Lollys." "Sir Preston is not returned," Sir Boris Blunt reported, "nor Aeron Santigar." "Nor wet nurse," said Sir Horace Redwine. That was the mocking name the other squires had hung on young Tyrek Lannister. Tyrion glanced around the yard. "Where's the Stark girl?" For a moment no one answered. Finally Joffrey said, "She was riding by me. I don't know where she went." Tyrion pressed blunt fingers into his throbbing temples. If Sansa Stark had come to harm, Jaime was as good as dead.
Sir Mandon, you were our shield.
Sir Mandon Moore remained untroubled.
When they mobbed the Hound, I thought first of the king.
And rightly so, Cersei put in. Boris, Meryn, go back and find the girl.
And my daughter?
Lady Tanda sobbed.
Please, sirs.
Sir Boris did not look pleased at the prospect of leaving the safety of the castle.
Your Grace, he told the Queen, the sight of our white cloaks might enrage the mob.
Tyrion had stomached all he cared to.
The others take your fucking cloaks.
Take them off, if you're afraid to wear them, you bloody oaf. But find me Sansa Stark, or I swear I'll have Shagger split that ugly head of yours in two to see if there's anything inside but black pudding.
Sir Boris went purple with rage.
You would call me ugly? You?
He started to raise the bloody sword still clutched in his mailed fist. Bronn shoved Tyrion unceremoniously behind him.
Stop it, Cersei snapped.
Boris, you'll do as you bid, or we'll find someone else to wear that cloak.
Your oath.
There she is, Joffrey shouted, pointing. Sandor Clegane cantered briskly through the gates astride Sansa's chestnut courser. The girl was seated behind, both arms tight around the Hound's chest. Tyrion called to her.
Are you hurt, Lady Sansa?
Blood was trickling down Sansa's brow from a deep gash on her scalp.
They were throwing things, rocks and filth, eggs. I tried to tell them I had no bread to give them. A man tried to pull me from the saddle. The Hound killed him, I think. His arm...
Her eyes widened, and she put a hand over her mouth.
He cut off his arm.
Clegane lifted her to the ground. His white cloak was torn and stained, and blood seeped through a jagged tear in his left sleeve.
The little bird's bleeding. Someone take her back to her cage and see to that cut.
Maester Franken scurried forward to obey.
They did for Santagar, the Hound continued. Four men held him down and took turns bashing at his head with a cobblestone. I gutted one. Not that it did Sir Aaron much good.
Lady Tanda approached him.
My daughter.
Never saw her.
The Hound glanced around the yard, scowling.
Where's my horse? If anything's happened to that horse, someone's going to pay.
He was running with us for a time, Tyrion said, but I don't know what became of him after that. Fire!
A voice screamed down from atop the barbican.
My lords, there's smoke in the city! Flea bottoms of fire!
Tyrion was unutterably weary, but there was no time for despair.
Bronn, take as many men as you need, and see that the water wagons are not molested.
Gods be good, the wildfire. If any blaze should reach that.
We can lose all of Flea Bottom if we must, but on no account must the fire reach the guild hall of the alchemists. Is that understood? Clegane, you'll go with him.
For half a heartbeat, Tyrion thought he glimpsed fear in the Hound's dark eyes.
Fire, he realized. The others take me, of course. He hates fire. He's tasted it too well.
The look was gone in an instant, replaced by Clegane's familiar scowl.
I'll go, he said, though not by your command. I need to find that horse.
Tyrion turned to the three remaining knights of the King's Guard.
Each of you will ride escort to a herald. Command the people to return to their homes. Any man found on the streets after the last peal of the evenfall bell will be killed.
Our place is beside the king, Sir Meryn said, complacent.
Cersei reared up like a viper.
Your place is where my brother says it is, she spit. The hand speaks with the king's own voice, and disobedience is treason.
Boris and Meryn exchanged a look.
Should we wear our cloaks, Your Grace? Sir Boris asked.
Go naked, for all I care. It might remind the mob that you're men. They're like to have forgotten after seeing the way you behaved out there in the street.
Tyrion let his sister rage. His head was throbbing. He thought he could smell smoke, though perhaps it was just the scent of his nerves fraying. Two of the stone crows guarded the door of the Tower of the Hand. Find me Timot, son of Timot.
Stone crows do not run squeaking after burned men,
one of the wildlings informed him haughtily. For a moment Tyrion had forgotten who he was dealing with. Then find me Shagger.
Shagger sleeps.
It was an effort not to scream, "Wake him!"
It is no easy thing to wake Shagger, son of Dorf, the man complained. His wrath is fearsome.
He went off grumbling. The clansmen wandered in, yawning and scratching.
Half the city is rioting, the other half is burning, and Shagger lies snoring,
Tyrion said.
Shagger mislikes your muddy water here, so he must drink your weak ale and sour wine, and after his head hurts.
I have Shay in a manse near the Iron Gate. I want you to go to her and keep her safe, whatever may come.
The huge man smiled, his teeth a yellow crevasse in the hairy wilderness of his beard.
Shagger will fetch her here.
Just see that no harm comes to her. Tell her I will come to her as soon as I may, this very night perhaps, or on the morrow for a certainty.
Yet by evenfall the city was still in turmoil, though Bronn reported that the fires were quenched and most of the roving mobs dispersed. Much as Tyrion yearned for the comfort of Shay's arms, he realized he would go nowhere that night. Sir Jaslyn Bywater delivered the butcher's bill as he was supping on a cold capon and brown bread in the gloom of his solar. Dusk had faded to darkness by then, but when his servants came to light his candles and start a fire in the hearth, Tyrion had roared at them and sent them running. His mood was as black as a chamber, and Bywater said nothing to lighten it. The list of the slain was topped by the High Septon, ripped apart as he squealed to his guards for mercy.
"Starving men take a hard view of priests too fat to walk," Tyrion reflected.
Sir Preston's corpse had been overlooked at first. The gold cloaks had been searching for a knight in white armour, and he had been stabbed and hacked so cruelly that he was red-brown from head to heel. Sir Aeron Santigar had been found in a gutter, his head a red pulp inside a crushed helm. Lady Tander's daughter had surrendered her maidenhood to half a hundred shouting men behind a tanner's shop. The gold cloaks found her wandering naked on Sour Belly Row. Tyrek was still missing, as was the High Septon's crystal crown. 9 gold cloaks had been slain, 20 wounded. No one had troubled to count how many of the mob had died.
"I want Tyrek found, alive or dead," Tyrion said curtly when Bywater was done. "He's no more than a boy, son to my late uncle, Tyget. His father was always kind to me. We'll find him, the Septon's crown as well. The others can bugger each other with the Septon's crown for all I care. When you named me to command the watch, you told me you wanted plain truth, always. Somehow I have a feeling I'm not going to like whatever you're about to say," Tyrion said gloomily. "We held the city today, my lord, but I make no promises for the morrow. The kettle is close to boiling. So many thieves and murderers are abroad that no man's house is safe. The bloody flux is spreading in the stews along Pisswater Bend. There's no food to be had for copper nor silver. Where before you heard only mutterings from the gutter, now there's open talk of treason in guild halls and markets. Do you need more men? I do not trust half the men I have now. Slint, triple the size of the watch, but it takes more than a gold cloak to make a watchman. There are good men and loyal among the new recruits, but also more brutes, sots, cravens, and traitors than you'd care to know. They're half-trained and undisciplined, and what loyalty they have is their own skins. If it comes to battle, they'll not hold, I fear." "I never expected them to," said Tyrion. "Once our walls are breached, we are lost. I've known that from the start. My men are largely drawn from the small folk. They walk the same streets, drink in the same wine sinks, spoon down their bowls of brown in the same pot shops. Your eunuch must have told you there is small love for the Lannisters in King's Landing. Many still remember how your lord father sacked the city when Ares opened the gates to him. They whisper the gods are punishing us for the sins of your house, for your brother's murder of King Ares, for the butchery of Rhaegar's children, for the execution of Eddard Stark, and the savagery of Joffrey's justice. Some people talk openly of how much better things were when Robert was king, and hint that times would be better again with Stannis on the throne. In potshops and wine sinks and brothels you hear these things, and in the barracks and guard halls as well, I fear. They hate my family. Is that what you're telling me? Aye, and will turn on them if the chance comes. Me as well. Ask your eunuch. I'm asking you. Bywater's deep-set eyes met the dwarf's mismatched ones and did not blink. You, most of all, my lord. Most of all. The injustice was like to choke him. It was Joffrey who told them to eat their dead. Joffrey who set his dog on them. How could they blame me? His grace is but a boy. In the streets, it is said that he has evil counsellors. The Queen has never been known as a friend to the commons, nor is Lord Varys called the Spider out of love. But it is you they blame most. Your sister and the eunuch were here when times were better under King Robert, but you were not. They say that you fill the city with swaggering sellswords and unwashed savages, brutes, who take what they want and follow no laws but their own. They say you exiled Jaina Slint because you found him too bluff and honest for your liking. They say you threw wise and gentle Pycelle into the dungeons when he dared raise his voice against you. Some even claim that you mean to seize the Iron Throne for your own. Yes, and I am a monster besides, hideous and misshapen. Never forget that. His hand coiled into a fist. I've heard enough. We both have work to attend to. Leave me. Perhaps my lord father was right to despise me all these years, if this is the best I can achieve, Tyrion thought when he was alone. He stared down at the remains of his supper, his belly roiling at the sight of the cold, greasy capon. Disgusted, he pushed it away, shot it for Pod, and sent the boy running to summon Varys and Bronn. My most trusted advisers are a eunuch and a sellsword, and my lady's a whore. What does that say of me? Bronn complained of the gloom when he arrived, and insisted on a fire in the hearth. It was blazing by the time Varys made his appearance. Where have you been? Tyrion demanded.
About the king's business, my sweet lord.
Ah, yes, the king, Tyrion muttered. My nephew is not fit to sit a privy, let alone the Iron Throne. Varys shrugged.
An apprentice must be taught his trade.
Half the apprentices on Reeking Lane could rule better than this king of yours. Bronn seated himself across the table and pulled a wing off the capon. Tyrion had made a practice of ignoring the sellsword's frequent insolences, but tonight he found it galling. I don't recall giving you leave to finish my supper.
You didn't look to be eating it, Bronn said through a mouthful of meat. City's starving. It's a crime to waste food. You have any wine?
Next he'll want me to pour it for him, Tyrion thought darkly. You go too far, he warned. And you never go far enough, Bronn tossed the wing bone to the rushes. Ever think how easy life would be if the other one had been born first? He thrust his fingers inside the capon and tore off a handful of breast. The weepy one, Tommen. Seems like he'd do whatever he was told, as a good king should. A chill crept down Tyrion's spine as he realized what the sellsword was hinting at. If Tommen was king? There was only one way Tommen would become king. No, he could not even think of it. Joffrey was his own blood, and Jaime's son as much as Cersei's. I could have your head off for saying that, he told Bronn, but the sellsword only laughed.
Friends, said Varys, quarrelling will not serve us. I beg you both, take heart.
Whose? Asked Tyrion sourly.
He could think of several tempting choices.
Brain. This is an evil dream, she thought. But if she were dreaming, why did it hurt so much? The rain had stopped falling, but all the world was wet. Her cloak felt as heavy as her mail. The ropes that bound her wrists were soaked through, but that only made them tighter. No matter how Brain turned her hands, she could not slip free. She did not understand who had bound her or why. She tried to ask the shadows, but they did not answer. Perhaps they did not hear her. Perhaps they were not real. Under her layers of wet wool and rusting mail, her skin was flushed and feverish. She wondered whether all of this was just a fever dream. She had a horse beneath her, though she could not remember mounting. She lay face down across his hindquarters like a sack of oats. Her wrists and ankles had been lashed together. The air was damp, the ground cloaked in mist. Her head pounded with every step. She could hear voices, but all she could see was the earth beneath the horse's hooves. There were things broken inside of her. Her face felt swollen, her cheek was sticky with blood, and every jounce and bounce sent a stab of agony through her arm. She could hear Podrick calling her as if from far away. "Sir," he kept saying, "Sir, m'lady, Sir, m'lady." His voice was faint and hard to hear. Finally, there was only silence. She dreamed she was at Harrenhal, down in the bear pit once again. This time it was Biter facing her, huge and bald and maggot-white, with weeping sores upon his cheeks. Naked he came, fondling his member, gnashing his filed teeth together. Brain fled from him. "My sword," she called. "Oathkeeper, please." The watchers did not answer. Renly was there with Nimble Dick and Catelyn Stark. Shagwell Pig and Timian had come, and the corpses from the trees with their sunken cheeks, swollen tongues, and empty eye sockets. Brain wailed in horror at the sight of them, and Biter grabbed her arm and yanked her close and tore a chunk from her face. "Jamie!" she heard herself scream. "Jamie!" Even in the depths of dream, the pain was there. Her face throbbed, her shoulder bled, breathing hurt. The pain crackled up her arm like lightning. She cried out for a maester. "We have no maester," said a girl's voice. "Only me." "I am looking for a girl," Brain remembered, "a high-born maid of 3 and 10 with blue eyes and auburn hair." "My lady," she said, "Lady Sansa." A man laughed. "She thinks you are Sansa Stark." "She can't go much farther. She'll die." "One less lion. I won't weep." Brain heard the sound of someone praying. She thought of Septon Meribald, but all the words were wrong. The night is dark and full of terrors, and so are dreams. They were riding through a gloomy wood, a dank, dark, silent place where the pines pressed close. The ground was soft beneath her horse's hooves, and the tracks she left behind filled up with blood. Beside her rode Lord Renly, Dick Crabb, and Vargo Hoat. Blood ran from Renly's throat. The goat's torn ear oozed pus. "Where are we going?" Brain asked. "Where are you taking me?" None of them would answer. How can they answer? All of them are dead. Did that mean that she was dead as well? Lord Renly was ahead of her, her sweet, smiling king. He was leading her horse through the trees. Brain called out to tell him how much she loved him, but when he turned to scowl at her, she saw that he was not Renly after all. Renly never scowled. "He always had a smile for me," she thought. "Except..." "Cold," her king said, puzzled, and a shadow moved without a man to cast it, and her sweet lord's blood came washing through the green steel of his gorget to drench her hands. He had been a warm man, but his blood was cold as ice. "This is not real," she told herself. "This is another bad dream, and soon I'll wake." Her mount came to a sudden halt. Rough hands seized hold of her. She saw shafts of red afternoon light slanting through the branches of a chestnut tree. A horse rooted amongst the dead leaves after chestnuts, and men moved nearby talking in quiet voices. 10, 12, maybe more. Brian did not recognize their faces. She was stretched out on the ground, her back against a tree trunk. "Drink this, my lady," said the girl's voice. She lifted a cup to Brian's lips. The taste was strong and sour. Brain spat it out.
Water, she gasped. Please, water.
Water won't help the pain.
This will, a little.
The girl put the cup to Brain's lips again. It even hurt to drink. Wine ran down her chin and dribbled on her chest. When the cup was empty, the girl filled it from a skin. Brain sucked it down until she sputtered.
No more.
More? You have a broken arm and some of your ribs is cracked.
Two, maybe three. Bite her,
Brain said, remembering the weight of him, the way his knee had slammed into her chest.
Aye, a real monster, that one.
It all came back to her, lightning above and mud below, the rain pinging softly against the dark steel of the hound's helm, the terrible strength in Biter's hands. Suddenly she could not stand being bound. She tried to wrench free of her ropes, but all that did was chafe her worse. Her wrists were tied too tightly. There was dried blood on the hemp.
Is he dead?
She trembled. Biter, is he dead? She remembered his teeth tearing into the flesh of her face. The thought that he might still be out there somewhere breathing made Brain want to scream.
He's dead. Gendry shoved the spear point through the back of his neck. Drink, m'lady, or I'll pour it down your throat.
She drank.
I am looking for a girl,
she whispered between swallows. She almost said, my sister. A high-born maid of 3 and 10. She has blue eyes and auburn hair.
I'm not her.
No. Brain could see that. The girl was thin to the point of looking starved. She wore her brown hair in a braid, and her eyes were older than her years.
Brown hair, brown eyes, plain.
Willow, 6 years older.
You're the sister. The innkeep.
I might be.
The girl squinted.
What if I am?
Do you have a name? Brain asked. Her stomach gurgled. She was afraid that she might retch.
Heddle. Same as Willow. Jane Heddle.
Jane, untie my hands. Please, have pity. The ropes are chafing my wrists. I'm bleeding.
It's not allowed. You're to stay bound till you stand before my lady.
Renly stood behind the girl, pushing his black hair out of his eyes.
Not Renly. Gendry.
M'lady means for you to answer for your crimes.
M'lady.
The wine was making her head spin. It was hard to think.
Stoneheart? Is that who you mean?
Lord Randall had spoken of her back at Maidenpool.
Lady Stoneheart.
Some call her that. Some call her other things. The Silent Sister. Mother Merciless. The Hangwoman.
The Hangwoman.
When Brain closed her eyes, she saw the corpses swaying underneath the bare brown limbs, their faces black and swollen. Suddenly, she was desperately afraid.
Podrick, my squire, where is Podrick and the others? Sir Hyle, Septon Meribald, Dog.
What did you do with Dog? Gendry and the girl exchanged a look. Brain fought to rise and managed to get one knee under her before the world began to spin.
It was you killed the dog, m'lady, she heard Gendry say, just before the darkness swallowed her again.
Then she was back at the Whispers, standing amongst the ruins, and facing Clarence Crabb. He was huge and fierce, mounted on an aurochs, shaggier than he was. The beast pawed the ground in fury, tearing deep furrows in the earth. Crabb's teeth had been filed into points. When Brain went to draw her sword, she found her scabbard empty.
No,
she cried, as Sir Clarence charged. It wasn't fair. She could not fight without her magic sword. Sir Jamie had given it to her. The thought of failing him as she had failed Lord Renly made her want to weep.
My sword. Please, I have to find my sword.
The wench wants her sword back, a voice declared.
And I want Cersei Lannister to suck my cock. So what? Jamie called it Oathkeeper. Please.
But the voices did not listen, and Clarence Crabb thundered down on her and swept off her head. Brain spiraled down into a deeper darkness. She dreamed that she was lying in a boat, her head pillowed on someone's lap. There were shadows all around them, hooded men in mail and leather, paddling them across a foggy river with muffled oars. She was drenched in sweat, burning yet somehow shivering too. The fog was full of faces.
Beauty,
whispered the willows on the bank, but the reed said, "Freak, freak." Brain shuddered. "Stop!"